Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is Blair Horner, the executive director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, or NYPIRG, as well as its chief lobbyist, and as well as probably the most knowledgeable man about what goes on in the Capitol of all. Congratulations on your promotion, Blair, to the head guy at NYPIRG, and welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah. I have a sense of something, Blair. Tell me if you think I'm right. I think Andrew Cuomo has shifted his approach to government. In other words, I think he has turned from a guy who was somewhat adventurous, beating up teachers, doing that kind of thing, to a guy who is now playing it the old classic Hubert Humphrey liberal way. You know, I'm for the unions, I'm for $15 minimum wage. And I think I'm detecting a different kind of Andrew. Do you think I'm wrong?
Never. I'm sure, as all your listeners would know, that would never be the case.
Probably right. That's why I like it so much.
Yeah, right. I mean, the governor has always had this sort of progressive, liberal, however you want to call it, streak in him. I mean, he's the guy who engineered gay marriage. He's pushed for gun control. I mean, where he's really been taking his lumps from the left wing of the party has been on his fiscal policies. And so I think the governor is, you know, he ran for re-election. He had, I think, a much more contested primary than he expected. And he's trying from the left. And so he's trying to, I think, mend his fences. And he's trying to do it in such a way that he doesn't box the Senate Republicans. So he's doing it using his executive powers. He wants to run up the score to sort of react to, I think, the pressure from the left without having to trade for those top items. With the Senate Republicans, and he gets a chance to sort of run the field on that at that end. So I think that's part of it. I mean, he is definitely when you talk to him, he's a person who like to use sports analogies, and I think that what he's been doing recently are things that he can do where he thinks he can run up the score.
I heard a recent commentary of yours about
this makes me nervous.
No, on the contrary, I thought it was very good. The way in which the governor and the administration was treating SUNY. Now I know that a lot of the members of NYPIRG are SUNY students, and
true.
So to some degree you represent their interests. I think that's true. But on the other hand, this governor has a closer sort of thumb on the heart of SUNY than any governor I have ever seen before. Is that right for starters?
Well, I mean, SUNY is another State University of New York is another state agency, and where you'll still see, I think, the governor's more tight-fisted fiscal policies will be in agency budgets. Every year, the governor talks about keeping state operating spending at no more than 2%, except for education and Medicaid, which is like half the budget, if not more. And so that means and they go up 4%. And so in other words, for the overall aggregate budget to be 2% and for the biggest two components to go up 4%, everyone else gets cut. And SUNY has not fared any better than any of the other agencies in that way. And so you couple that with a sort of historic trend in New York State government of pulling back state support for SUNY and replacing it with money out of students' wallets. That's what's happened under this governor as well. And part of it is the fiscal policies of the state, and part of it is a national trend. I mean, New York is not unique in this way. If you look at all the states in the country, they've been basically doing the same thing. The public colleges, instead of being viewed as a public good, are viewed as a subsidized way for people to go to college, but they have to pony up a lot more than they used to. If you looked at the trend, my guess would be, if you looked at the trend from the 70s till now and you factored in inflation for private and public college tuition in the 70s, that the private colleges factored for inflation would be the public college tuition now. And that it's been really a significant shift over time. It's a policy that's really not been debated, and it's largely driven it's driven to some extent by ideology. And in New York, it's driven by a focus on shifting resources somewhere else. tax cuts or whatever the heck it is.
So you, in your commentary, said there were promises broken. Were there?
That's right. Well, I mean, specifically in New York, 5 years ago, the governor and the legislature said, well, we're going to create something called SUNY 2020, and we're going to have students pay more every year annually, so it'll be a predictable tuition hike of roughly $300 a year, as much as $300 a year. And the state would maintain its efforts so that the state wouldn't say, well, you're going to pay more and we're going to pull back our funding, and therefore your increase just plows back into the hole and things don't improve. So the theory was students would pay more, the money would be plowed into additional student services, and the state would maintain its effort. But when you get into the details of that law, and that was the promise, when you get into the details of the law that passed, it didn't factor in inflation. So the state support stayed flat every year, year after year, even though inflation would go up. Therefore, it led to basically a cut. So where'd the money come from? It came from the students. So we view that as a broken promise, because maintaining your effort on a technical level, it's not violating the law, but you're not factoring in increases in fixed costs, employee salary increases, inflation. None of those things were considered. And so flat money 5 years ago means a cut today, and that's what's happened.
Let me switch gears here. The other thing in state politics everybody's watching are these two very famous trials, Shelley Silver and, of course, the Senate Dean Skelos. So what are you seeing as you read the New York Times every day about the testimony that's going on there?
Well, and at one level, it's not surprising. At another level, it's mind-blowing, right? It's not surprising in the sense that here's another elected official who allegedly was using his public office for private gain. I mean, there's been a whole series of guys heading off to the pokey over the years that have had that allegation, and they paid the price. Former Senate Majority Leader Joe Bruno had that allegation made, and he didn't pay the price. His campaign contributors did, but
I got to say, he paid an awful price for a lot of years.
He basically no one denied that he was using his public office for private gain, and he just didn't violate a law doing it. And so, in the case of Silver, that's what you're reading about. But what the mind blowing part is sort of how incredibly complicated all of these financial arrangements were, and how carefully he covered his tracks. Now, again, I think it's an open question as to whether or not he violated any law, but no matter what happens with him, and for that matter, for the former Senate Majority Leader Skelos, if both of them are found to be innocent, I think Albany's has been convicted. I think it's detestable that we allow, legally or otherwise, elected officials to use their public office for private gain. They're supposed to be public servants, and that's why we've argued that New York should follow the congressional model and limit outside incomes. And then you wouldn't have the opportunity to sort of game the system for your own private gain. And often that can be at the public's expense.
Why in the world would this legislature, considering its background and what it's done in the past, vote to rein itself in and their money-making possibilities?
Well, you know, you're talking to an eternal optimist, Alan.
You're talking to an eternal pessimist. And I'm right more than I'm wrong.
You're always right. I think our listeners, we established that in the beginning of this conversation.
So we did.
Why would they do it? Well, it's an election year.
Yeah.
If both former Senate Majority Leader are convicted, and others are dragged in under the dragnet of, the modern-day Elliot Ness in New York, pre-Perara, well, then they may feel like they have to do something, particularly if they're on the cusp of getting a pay raise. They may feel like that they actually have to do something about it. So I admit that that's in sort of what they would call in football a Hail Mary pass.
Or Never Never Land.
Or Peter Pan might say it that way. But you asked me how, and I think that the rationale for it is going to be external pressure, or for whatever reason the governor decides to get religion on this and decide to push the envelope. I mean, really, historically, it's the governors who drive reform. And whatever reforms have occurred under Governor Cuomo have been at his initiative. More people get convicted, more people get arrested, more people get dragged before the court in shackles. I think the more pressure there is on lawmakers in an election year, particularly one where it's presidential and more people are going to show up to vote.
You know, I really liked what you just said, which was that Albany's been convicted. See, I think Pete Berar, the fighting U.S. attorney, gets great credit for having done that. I've heard a few people say, Well, you know, if he, and I've seen printed commentary that says, you know, if he doesn't get convictions of these two, that he'll look bad. No, I think he looks good because he did take the cover off the cesspool.
Well, I mean, it will be better for him if they're convicted, right? Because he's the one who arrested them and dragged them through the whole thing. And if they're both found innocent, then it'll look like that he overreached. That being said, he's toppled two of the most powerful political figures in New York State, one of them arguably one of the most powerful in New York history, and it has definitely shook up the system. If both of them are found innocent, which again, you know, they're innocent until proven guilty, then the pressure will be off in terms of the institutional pressure to change Albany.
They had people testifying from his law firm, where he collected $3.4 million in fees without doing any legal work at all.
Yeah, right.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah, I wish I could get one of those jobs where you just show up, get paid millions of dollars, and have nothing to do.
Time to go back to law school.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Okay.
But I think, I mean, in this case, I mean, the argument was that he was finding them good clients that they could then make a lot more money off of. So in a sense, it's a finder's fee for the lawyer.
Yeah.
And the reason he was able to identify such great cases for them to bring was because, according to the evidence that we've seen so far, he had worked out a deal with this doctor who has a expertise in treating mesothelioma. And the patients that go through that, you can identify who has a really good case and who doesn't. So in a sense, they weren't cold calls. He had hot leads, and he was driving state money to this particular doctor. Now, you know, again, he was an expert in the field. The argument will be whether or not that turns out to be a kickback or not, and that's what the jury will have to decide.
But in order to have a kickback, wouldn't you have to have a specific tape recording on a telephone of somebody saying, I'll do this for you if you do that for me?
I think that that would make the case more airtight. We will see if the U.S. Attorney's Office can convince a jury that the preponderance of evidence make what looks like fire turn out to be based, what looks like smoke, to have actually come from fire. We don't know yet, it is an unbelievable tale, though. I mean, it really is, and the U.S. Attorney's Office has done a lot of work to get this at such an extraordinary, and there are people who were involved in these arrangements who have been identified and have turned state's evidence, and I think that's going to be, in some ways, when the lobbyists start to sing, I think that's when the defense is going to have a harder time.
You know, Blair Horner, I've always believed that the real problem here is not a few corrupt leaders, but that the rank and file of the, quote, good legislators, the ones who wouldn't think of stealing, but who hold up their hands to elect these guys, really, when do they turn around and when do they say enough already?
Well, when the voters say, unless you do something, you're going to have to get a new job. I mean, that's what it turns out to be. Most elected officials in the state legislature, both the Assembly and Senate, most of them do not have outside jobs, or they don't have substantial outside jobs. And so they probably don't even know of these arrangements. I mean, nobody seems to have, except for the doctor in this case or the lobbyists that were helping to engineer it. And they only had pieces of this particular scheme.
Well, we all knew that we weren't going to have what's so-called tort reform in New York State as long as Shelley Silver worked for Whites in Luxembourg,
I understand the logic of that, but the Assembly's been opposed to that since before the Speaker was Speaker.
A lot of trial lawyers in the Assembly.
There are some lawyers, there's no doubt about it, but I think it's a Democratic position.
Yeah.
The Democratic Party's position is to look out for the rights of the consumer, and arguably that's what the trial lawyers are doing. So, I mean, all of that stuff, I mean, I think Silver's personal life and personal gain out of this arrangement, I don't think was clear to the members. It will be clear now, and depending on what happens with Skelos, the Senate majority will know it too, and then they have to face the voters, and they're going to tell the voters, we did nothing because we saw this unbelievable thing and we've done nothing about it, or we've done something about it.
Or we didn't know.
But they now know. And they're going into a session, so what are they going to do about it? This comes back to your original question.
Pessimism versus optimism?
That's it.
Pessimism
you got
wins.
It. You got it.
Okay,
I'm
let's,
an eternally optimistic guy.
Let's go to Cuomo versus de Blasio. I believe Cuomo is the initiator of this fight and that he doesn't stop and he won't stop. But I don't understand it. I don't think it does good things for him. He looks like a bully. People call him a bully.
Well, you know, I mean, the historical tension between the two most powerful executives in the state goes back a long way,
oh, yes.
right? I mean, so Rudy Giuliani and George Pataki with each other's throats.
John Lindsay and Nelson Rockefeller.
Rudy Giuliani endorsed Mario Cuomo for governor, right? And so, I mean, that relationship was poisoned. So, I mean, there's some of that. Some of this is, you know, whatever the backstory is between de Blasio and Cuomo, who were supposedly such buddies. When the mayor got elected, I mean, they went back to HUD, they worked together, supposedly had this great relationship, but turned sour. Some of it is the institutional tension between the executives. Some of it is this fight for between the governor and the more liberal elements of the party, who de Blasio got elected with the support of those folks. And so part of it is this is really about that tension between the left wing of the Democratic Party and the governor. You put it all together, though, it is pretty fierce, and you know, whether or not it means anything, of course, we won't know for another year, because 2017, I believe, is when the next mayor is up, when the mayor's up for re-election, and that's when this will start to play out.
Blair Horner, we have something in New York State called the Working Families Party.
That's right.
We used to have something called the Liberal Party. It went down in flames because it became sort of, is it right to say, the hind leg of the Democratic Party?
It went down the tubes because it, as you may recall, had endorsed Andrew Cuomo to be its candidate in 2002. And when then Andrew Cuomo pulled out, the Liberal Party couldn't get the 50,000 votes it needed to stay on the line.
Yeah, but
and
they
then
also
its
had
boss
some,
went off to jail.
Yeah, well, I was going to say that. It had some problematic leadership.
So it wasn't the Democrat. It wasn't the fact that it was allied with the Democratic Party that was its undoing. It was the fact that it got into trouble because it had endorsed someone who was not the Democratic Party standard bearer, and you know, its longtime boss was involved in unethical and illegal activities.
Well, you know, Blair, I do remember the days that the Liberal Party was a respected organization in New York. It stopped being that a long time ago. It fades out of existence. We got something, nature abhors a vacuum, we got something called the Working Families Party. And they showed some real flair for getting some votes. And then there was a question whether they would endorse somebody named Zephyr Teachout. It got very close, and Bill de Blasio, of all people, came in and saved the governor's hash and said, we have to do this. What's the future of the Working Families Party?
Well, I mean, as long as they keep the ballot. I mean, for your listeners, New York is unusual in the sense that it allows for fusion
yeah.
voting. So if you run on a major party line and a minor party line, when they figure out who wins and who losses in the races, they add them all up, so it's the aggregate total.
As long as your lieutenant governor nominee is the same on both places.
Well, that's right. In the case of a statewide elected official, you're right, the lieutenant governor does matter who the lieutenant governor is, because the tickets have to match.
I only say that because Tim Wu, who was the potential lieutenant governor candidate in the Working Families Party, he presented a real problem, and they had to beat him under the table.
Yeah, I mean, ironically, if Zephyr Teachout had run for lieutenant governor and Tim Wu had run for governor, she might have won. And so that's sort of interesting. I mean, it's a dynamic within the party. Since these minor parties are part of a fusion ticket, they have clout that far exceeds their membership. I mean, the Working Families Party doesn't have a whole lot of members in the state.
No.
But because it's able to, because in a sense it's a brand, it's identified as the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, essentially. It gets over the threshold for votes. It's on the ticket. People want to have another line. And so, like, the Independence Party, the Conservative Party, Working Families Party, the Green Party now, although they're not really involved in fusion, those lines matter. People want to run on multiple lines. The Reform Party, which used to be the Common Core Party, now is on the line. The Women's Equality Party. The reason people want extra lines is when you go into the ballot box, your name shows up a lot of times. So I think the Working Families Party, it has the muscle of the unions. It has a line that people want because it's a brand. As long as it doesn't get into trouble,
well,
it'll be around.
Well, my only take on that is that the unions are part of the problem, because the only reason that Andrew Cuomo got to be their nominee, other than the fact that de Blasio pleaded, was that the unions, the big unions in the state, were for Cuomo.
Just so you listen, I'm not enrolled in any political party. I'm in the third biggest political party, which is the none of the above party, known as the blanks.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're, I mean, you know, how the unions help create the Working Families Party. Of course, they're going to feel like they have some say-so over what happens with it. They have other fish to fry with the governor besides just partisan politics. So, you know, played out, however it played out, and the Working Families Party either will, you know, do better as a result of that or do worse. But as long as they can keep getting they can meet the minimum standard for candidate for governor and they stay on the ballot, they will be a force to be reckoned with.
You, of course, are not only the head of NYPIRG, but you're the chief lobbyist. And I know one thing young people are for. I know one thing that you're personally for. I'm sure NYPIRG is for it, which is making election access easier as opposed to harder.
Right.
So same-day registration, for example. The state Senate doesn't want it. If the state Senate goes Democratic, you might get your wish.
Yeah. Well, maybe. I mean, you know.
You never know.
Right. Because sometimes people say they're supportive things. And when they have power, they're like, oh, did I ever say that? I have amnesia.
Yeah, especially since you dance with the one who brought you, and you may not want.
Well, I mean, when it comes to, in a sense, loosening voting standards, you're asking the people who win the game to change the rules that they want.
Sure.
Right? And so that's always a hard
thing.
Even
if they're Democrats.
Even if they're Democrats, Republicans, whatever, right? But it is, in my opinion, bad public policy that in a country that's a democracy, that your registration is something you have to petition for, that you don't just get it automatically. You get the automatic right to vote as long as you can register yourself as a voter.
And it's a very restricted.
It's a crazy way to do it, right? I mean, as soon as you're 18, you should be in the system, and that's it. And you're allowed to vote. What's the big deal? Why do you have to hop through all these hoops to find out where the voter registration form is and download a PDF and fill it out and mail it in? Why? I mean, if you're a young male and you haven't signed up for the Selective Service, they find you and they make sure you do that. If you're turning 50, AARP finds you to make sure that you can join AARP if you want to. I mean, why is this such a big deal? I don't understand it. Other than the people who get elected by the electorate that's in place now, and they're concerned about new voters showing up who might throw them out and put in somebody else.
Does Andrew Cuomo run for governor a third time?
Well, I mean, it's a good question for him. I mean, he's certainly making all the moves.
Well, actually, I didn't ask it to him. I asked it to you.
I know, but I mean, he knows. I don't know. But if at this point in his second term, he has to at least act like that's what he wants to do. Because once he's a lame duck, it's a hell of a lot harder to get anything done. So he's doing all of the things that would allow him to run for a third term. What he chooses to do may be a function of what happens in the presidential election. And what new options may come his way as a result of that or not. But I think the wise move, the smart political move, is to keep the doors open and see what it looks like in another couple of years.
Syracuse Mayor Stephanie Miner has had a radio interview in which she said she would look at running for governor herself at some point. She and the governor have not always seen eye to eye on things. Could an upstate Democrat win?
Let's play the historical game. When was the last one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well,
it's been long. What, Harriman? I mean, I'm not even sure if Harriman and Roosevelt count as upstate, right? I mean, they had upstate. I mean, Roosevelt was from the Hudson Valley, right, when he was in
assembly.
He had his little palace in Manhattan, right?
Palace,
and Harriman was the same way. So when was the last upstate? You know, I think they wore tri-cornered hats and stockings, right? And when was the last upstate governor, if you don't count Peekskill as upstate, which really you really
well, I have
right?
always counted anything above Yonkers as upstate.
Oh, well, you go. Then Pataki's an upstate, right? But I mean, if you have a more sort of general sense of it, it's very hard. I mean, the votes aren't upstate. We have a state of roughly 20 million people. Roughly a third of them live north of the Putnam, Rockland area. Two-thirds live south of that. And so I think you're going to the base of power politics in the state emanates from the southern part of the state. Now, that being said, you never can tell, right? If somebody like a Hillary Clinton decides to move to New York, but doesn't move to Chappaqua, but moves to Chautauqua, someone like that might be able to win.
Indeed. We are out of time. Our guest has been the amazing Blair Horner, now the executive director, the head man of NYPIRG. Congratulations again, Blair, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gastina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.